It is Monday, June 17th, 2024, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Today, a company providing professional development services to the state of Arkansas for the last 7 years is now withdrawing their proposal to continue those services.
How did everything so good get so bad so quick?
A conversation with the CEO of Solution Tree, plus a journey from rural Arkansas to Hollywood.
Amanda just went right ahead and said, well, I will do a show about four women, and it's called Designing Women, and it's got all these women in it, and just about their lives and what happens to them. And the guy on the phone said, listen, why don't you come over here? I think we can sell that show right now.
Harry Thomason helped bring Designing Women to TV and helped to put Bill Clinton in the White House. We'll discover more with the help of Pryor Center Archives. First, the news from NPR.
The 73rd season of Opera in the Ozarks kicks off June 21st at Inspiration Point in Eureka Springs, with 22 performances over 4 weeks, featuring 40 premier vocalists from across the nation performing Giuseppe Verdi's La Traviata, Robert Ward's The Crucible, and a double bill featuring Vittorio Giannini's Beauty and the Beast and Maurice Ravel's L'Enfant à la Sortilège. Tickets and season schedule at opera.org.
This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, June 17th, 2024. I'm Kyle Kellums. Later this hour, how Harry Thomason moved from high school football coach in rural Arkansas to Hollywood producer. He's this week's focus of our time with archives from the Pryor Center and Randy Dixon. That's ahead. Earlier this month, the Arkansas Department of Education terminated a proposed $99 million contract with the company Solution Tree. This came after the company's CEO, Jeff Jones, asked to withdraw the company's proposal to provide professional development services to Arkansas educators. Solution Tree has a 7-year contract that expires June 30th. And right now, there's uncertainty whether anyone will be contracted to provide those services next fiscal year. In a statement from the Department of Education spokesperson, the department, quote, felt it was prudent to do its due diligence and address additional questions and concerns before moving forward with the contract. Ozarks at Large's Matthew Moore recently spoke with Jones about all of this. Jones says Solution Tree's relationship with the state of Arkansas goes back to 2016, and then Representative Bill Gossage.
He came from education. He had implemented professional learning communities in his school and then became a legislator and was saying, this really works. We have to change education in the state of Arkansas. This has to happen. So he brought a handful of legislators to what we call our summit, which is our big event in Phoenix, Arizona, every year around the 1st of February. And he came, like Brian Evans came and John Eubanks came and some others. They let us know they were coming. And so we hosted them through the whole thing. They went to the event just like every other attendee. There's 2,500 people come to this event. We had some sessions where they talked to some of the presenters. Then they came back and said, oh, they came back to Arkansas, regrouped, worked with us, contacted us again, came back to the 2017 summit in Phoenix. And at that point, we started writing how we could help Arkansas. So what they wanted to do is take a school or 10 schools in cohort one, and it was $4 million. So it's $400,000 per school, and to implement deeply professional learning communities. There's something like 50 on-site days of professional learning communities. And if you implement it with fidelity, you end up getting great results. So you got to try and figure out. So they did an application process. Schools applied to be in the 10 schools. So that's the process that they went. Well, they found that it was working so well. Not only were we getting great results, but also the schools were clamoring for it. So 4 of the 7 years that we were in the contract, they increased the number of schools that were going to be in it. So that's how the contract grew in size by design, but it was $100 million that went to legislation that says over the course of 7 years, we've got this pool of money that we're going to do, which is really interesting because we ended up spending in the 7 years, they ended up spending $83.9 million with us for this whole contract. And it came into question, like, how did this contract get so big and how did it become a $149 million contract? Well, for one, it's not a $149 million contract. We've gone back and we uncovered that if you go to transparency.arkansas.gov, I think is what it's called, there's our PLC at Work project, which is 83.9. There's another one in there for $66 million that we have no idea what it is. And we went to the statewide procurement office, and they don't know what it is. There's no paperwork. There's no contract. It's just listed. So you combine those two numbers, you get to $149 million, but we don't have any, and our name is attached to it. We can't find out who signed it, who put it in. So anyways, it's an $83.9 million contract, of which each year it goes back to the legislation for approval. And for those 7 years, they said, we're not only going to approve it, we want to add more money to it. All the legislators get to vote. So it's not like there was any secret about this. This is extremely transparent. And again, we don't know where the misinformation came that there's another $66 million. Nobody can, the office can't figure it out.
This contract is coming to a close. And so a new contract was sent out for a request for proposal. Solution Drew was one of eight companies who placed a bid with the Department of Ed to do this work. Your contract was rated the best. When did things begin to deteriorate?
How did everything so good get so bad so quick? So yeah, it was an RFP around professional learning communities again. But the interesting thing is there are two pieces that go into this. You could either do 500 occasions, which was part of the RFP, or you could build a systems of professional learning, a comprehensive plan. Well, obviously we went towards the comprehensive plan, the systems of learning, the whole thing. If we'd have gone for the 500, our price would have been the same as everybody else's, around 20 some million dollars over the course of that. But we already knew we're comprehensive. I don't believe that anybody else submitted a full comprehensive plan, because you almost can't. And you actually, if you took our cost per service and broke it down per session, we were cheaper than most of the competition. What are you trying to do? But we had such a robust plan. How it became so controversial so fast. You could say that it's because competition was not happy that Solution Tree is going to win this big contract again. You could say some legislators that had the desire for these other people to do it. You could say somebody looked at it and said, whoa, $149 million, what is that? How quick that came out. You could say, well, this University of Arkansas report came out extremely fast. And it was disparaging about what our project is. And so everybody's going to say, whoa, wait. So we then went through the whole process. You know, it was on Tuesday. We were fine. We were coming back on Friday. Everything started to go. We were in communication. And you could see that the scope of the project was going to switch to the LEARNS Act, which there's several things in the LEARNS Act that we're not capable of addressing. Merit pay, tutoring, a whole bunch of things in there. So if the contract was going to switch, because all this controversy was stewing around, to focusing on the LEARNS Act, not only were we set up for failure, but we were set up to spend Arkansas's money, and we can't do it.
When you were first given the request for proposal, I know that there tends to be language around what are the expectations, like what are the desired outcomes for the work that you're doing. Was the LEARNS Act talked about at all in the request for proposal?
The original proposal was back quite a way, so I can't respond exactly what was in the RFP. But the RFP was, again, for professional learning comprehensive plan. It didn't say LEARNS Act in it, but there were some components in it that we knew. So when we responded to our plan, it had nothing to do with any of the other things. It had everything to do with what we know how to do, which is extend the professional learning communities at work. The review committee gave us a technical score of, yep, you did everything that you're supposed to do. Perfect score. Now, if there was going to be a twist in the LEARNS Act that was not in the RFP, and you can't go through all the details of everything that you want done in one RFP, it then became known that it was more and more going to lean towards LEARNS Act. And I think it morphed. I think there was a lot of behind the scenes conversation of, we really need to support this LEARNS Act. And if we're going to spend $149 million, which it's not, or even if we're going to spend $99.4 million, I think is what our proposal was, we need to address some of these other priorities. But it came towards the end of the whole process. I've said this before. I don't have anything against the LEARNS Act. I mean, the LEARNS Act is what Governor Sanders ran on. It's no secret what was in there. It's her plan. I'm not going to say it's right or wrong, because that's not my area of expertise. That's her plan, and everybody voted for it. So let's go for it. Let's make it work. I have nothing against her LEARNS plan at all.
So your concern there is that the work that you do and the work that your company does wouldn't be compatible with what they are hoping to attain with the LEARNS Act?
Not all aspects of it. A lot of the LEARNS Act we certainly can do. It seems to us that the scope of the project was changing, not just around professional learning communities, and that it was going to be evaluated on an annual basis if you're achieving these things that are attached outside of professional learning communities. And again, we pulled our we're not pulling out of Arkansas. We just pulled our contract out of consideration. And whatever the state wants to do, if we can do it, we will apply. If we can't do it, we won't apply. It seemed like the overall plan was changing on what they wanted to have done to fulfill their goals. We wanted to be fair and honest and say, you know, we should pull out. And we're also being villainized. So, you know, and we're going to be under a magnifying glass and everybody's going to find exactly everything that we might be doing wrong. It'll be on the news again. So
say more about that. What, when you say you're being villainized, do you think people are taking out of context what you do, or what do you mean specifically by that thought?
Well, I probably shouldn't have said that. Now I walked right into it. The University of Arkansas report, I sent it to two scholars that I know. I sent it to two independent researchers that I know, and we sent it to five university research centers. And every one of them called the validity into question. And they had specifics into question, and they're all consistent. Was it statistically significant? It wasn't statistically significant. The matching process was invalid. Sampling has a concern. Baseline equivalence had concern. Study design, for instance, they used a study design is called an event study. An event study is only suited to evaluate the impact of a one-time event, not a long-term effect with multiple variables in control. So that was one. They had weighted achievement, which is highly concerning. It's how a study is calculated, weighted biased against PLC at work. And then there's value-added models. So this came out and it said in partnership with DESE, except the Department of Education doesn't know where exactly how that happened either, how their name got attached to it, because I think what they were probably doing was using DESE's data. I don't know that they're in partnership with DESE.
And DESE stands for Department of
Elementary Secondary Education, yeah.
So what you're saying is that the department didn't claim that they were a partner of this study, that what likely happened is they used data that DESE gave them.
That's what we're assuming, because it says in partnership with DESE, and it probably was supposed should have said in partnership with DESE data. I don't know. The report was done very fast. It didn't have peer reviews, all sorts of things. Well, if you're a legislator, or if you're somebody who's concerned about a $99 million contract, like you should be or could be, and this report comes out, that's your evidence of effectiveness that we got a problem, that something's wrong. And we have reams of evidence that shows what we do works. We've been doing it for 27 years. If we don't do it right by now, who would buy our stuff?
What has your experience been with Secretary Oliva?
I've never met him. I mean, he's been to some of our events. We've got an office in the Simmons building that we do a lot of our training at to make it easier. The Department of Education has access 100% of the time for no cost, just to come use it for training centers, which they do for things that aren't solution tree driven, but they can do them. So he knows us. He knows our work. He knew it in Florida. My empathy is that his job is huge. I mean, if you're in charge of pre-K through higher education in the state of Arkansas, coming from the state of Florida, as fast as you can go, with a new governor who's changing a lot of the different things to the LEARNS Act, and I'm sure he was part of helping design the LEARNS Act just because he's a great educator, from what I understand. I think he's got a tough job. I think he's got a really hard job.
What do you hope people know about Solution Tree that maybe they haven't seen written about or, you know, talked about in the media?
That's a great question. We have been doing this for 27 years now. This is my 27th year of leading this company. And in 2001, I had 7 employees and myself. That was it. That's the whole company. Now we're 385 or something around the country, like we had talked about before. And in 27 years, and in all the business that we've done, I have never once had the company's integrity called into question. Not once. I mean, this is painful to me. This is gut-wrenching. I mean, one of our guiding principles is integrity, period. It's the most important guiding principle. So to have our integrity and have what we do called into question, and some of the things that have been written about us, it hurts. So what we're going to do is everything we can. We're not going to defame somebody else, but we are going to defend our work. We are going to defend our research. Right before this conversation, I just had a report on research firms that we're now going to reach out to that's going to build the evidence of effectiveness like we did with Ed Northwest for Arkansas into all of our contracts. We're going to have what's, I call this isn't a great phrase, a plug and play, which is one that we're going to collect and give you the data, or we can build into contracts. We're going to have independent researchers because our stuff is tested and proven.
One of the things that I'm sure you're worried about is that your work to improve education, to elevate teachers to their best possible version of themselves, has gotten politicized through all of this. How do you combat that?
The only way we can combat it is just by having the data. I mean, data rules. That's another one of our guiding principles, data rules. So we're just going to keep telling our story. We're just going to keep doing our thing. If somebody disparages us, we're going to defend ourselves, but we're not going to go attack anybody. I'm not going to attack any legislator. I'm not going to attack any competition. It is what it is.
Jeff Jones is the CEO of SolutionTree. He spoke with Ozarks at Large's Matthew Moore last week via Zoom. Ozarks at Large reached out to the Department of Education to request an interview about this terminated contract and for more details about the $66 million contract listed under SolutionTree that they claim they do not have. The spokesperson declined multiple requests for interviews and did not offer clarification about the $66 million contract. Later on Ozarks at Large, Harry Thomason had a childhood in Hampton, Arkansas. A brief career as a high school football coach helped create one of the iconic sitcoms of the 1980s and worked to get a fellow Arkansan into the White House.
I never want to hear the word ticket again as long as I live. Because it's very tough. I mean, we started out to make this the most accessible inauguration ever, and we're trying to take as many, as care of as many people as we can. That doesn't include only actors, that includes farmers in Ohio that worked on the campaign too, and we've tried to be very even-handed.
Harry Thomason is a producer, director, and storyteller, and we'll follow his life from small-town Arkansas to Hollywood with the help of Pryor Center Archives. That's ahead on today's Ozarks at Large.
You're listening to Norman Corwin read
The Runaway by Robert Frost.
You're on The Soundbeat.
Once, when the first snow of the year was beginning to fall, we stopped by a mountain pasture to say, "Who's called?"
The poem describes travelers and their encounter with a young colt left out in a snowstorm. So, not to play poet psychologist here, but maybe Frost's concern for the youngster relates to his own childhood. A nervous student from the start, he was sent home from kindergarten on his first day with stomach pains. The same condition would follow him throughout his schooling, even during college at Harvard. Frost would never receive an actual degree from there, or anywhere, but would amass over 40 honorary ones.
He's running away. I doubt if even his mother could tell him, "Sakes, it's only weather." He'd think she didn't know.
He was also named consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress, a title since renamed Poet Laureate. Corwin himself was known as the Poet Laureate of Radio. For more on this broadcasting legend, go to soundbeat.org right now.
Whoever it is that leaves him out so late when other creatures have gone to stall and bin ought to be told to come and take him in.
Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Library. I'm Brett Barry.
Pleasant Monday. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. An Arkansas judge is dismissing a lawsuit over abortion in the workplace. Little Rock Public Radio's Josie Lenora has more.
In 2022, the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act was passed with bipartisan support in the U.S. Congress. The law required employers to accommodate pregnancy and childbirth-related medical conditions. In April, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission expanded the law to include accommodations from abortion. This means an employer may have to provide unpaid leave to an employee needing an abortion. A legal challenge to the rules was brought by testimony from several human resources workers across the country, including an HR employee for the Arkansas Attorney General. They said they, as employers, could hypothetically be harmed financially by having an employee seek an abortion. U.S. District Judge D. Price Marshall Jr. says the plaintiffs in the case did not have standing and didn't establish harm. Marshall was not persuaded by their arguments, calling them speculative and hypothetical. He said the scenarios presented by the plaintiffs did not accurately reflect the current state of abortion in America. In Little Rock, I'm Josie Lenora.
A special session of the Arkansas legislature is underway. Part of the session's purpose will be to cut taxes. Governor Sanders is asking for a new top income tax rate of 3.9%, with 4.3% top rate tax rate for corporations. Governor also wants to expand the homestead tax credit. That would be a tax break used for people who own their own property. In an interview with Arkansas PBS, Michael Cook, political strategist for Democratic lawmakers, says the tax cuts won't provide tax relief to the working class.
This tax proposal is going to be just for the wealthy. If you're a school teacher who makes $50,000 a year, you're going to get an extra 11 bucks a month based on this tax cut. If you make $1 million a year, you're going to get $5,000 extra a year in your pocket. So that's one example of how these tax cuts are geared toward the wealthy.
Bill Vickery, a Republican analyst, says higher earners pay more in taxes. That's the reason why higher earners will see more tax relief.
If you earn more, you pay more. So consequently, the tax cut's going to affect you more. If what you earn, it's relative to your income. I mean, that's why we have a graduated income tax. That's why it takes a percentage of our income.
Vickery also says the states with the most growth in population are states with lower taxes. The special session is underway as of today. The state's largest Juneteenth celebration brought thousands of people to downtown Springdale Saturday. There's plenty of food, plenty of music, including a performance from the Arkansas Gospel Chorale.
Arkansas Gospel Chorale is a new community choir based in Northwest Arkansas. So whether you grew up around gospel music, have never been to a church service, or you've always just wanted to sing a choir song or choir music, you are welcome to become part of this melodious group of dynamic singers. All skill levels and ages are welcome.
And about a block and a half away from the stage, something new for this year's Juneteenth, horseback rides from the Rough Rider Saddle Club based in Fort Smith.
And we just a group that's an organization to enjoy, you know, let people enjoy riding horses. A lot of people that want to have horses can't, you know, afford horses or so. So we just come out and let the kids ride.
Gregory Robinson says he began his relationship with horses when he was a five-year-old in Oklahoma. He says the group participates in events like this weekend's Juneteenth celebration just to let children and adults become more familiar with what it takes to ride.
All you have to do is listen and enjoy yourself, but they can be dangerous. They can be dangerous. That's what we tell folks, and just let them know that it's very fun and they can be dangerous. So we don't want nobody to get hurt, so we just tell them, you know, exactly what to do and not to do. So we just do the do's and don'ts.
Saturday's observation was the fifth annual, staged in downtown Springdale, and was organized by Music Moves and Interform. Juneteenth was also celebrated Saturday in Little Rock. Mayor Frank Scott Jr. says he's proud of how the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center is able to highlight the holiday each year.
The city of Little Rock is proud to be the first city in the state of Arkansas to recognize Juneteenth as an official holiday within the city with paid time off for its employees. We want other cities to follow suit as we continue to focus on black freedom, equity, justice, and accountability. And this is what it's all about, to talk about our history, to make certain everyone understands and learns from history so we don't repeat it. It's all about this. Happy Juneteenth.
Juneteenth celebrates the date in June 1865 when the state of Texas officially recognized the freedom of enslaved people following the Emancipation Proclamation. The official date for the holiday is June 19th, Wednesday. This is Ozarks at Large. It's a Monday edition of Ozarks, means it's time to dive into Arkansas history. Here's our guide, Randy Dixon, with the Pryor Center.
Hello, Kyle. Hello, it's great Randy. To be here.
Yeah. And, you know, we've been on this roll. We had Helen Gurley Brown last week. We had, you know, those David Pryor additions. We had Hillary Clinton. And you another, not political, but another really towering figure.
Well, and
history.
We started off with a snappy tune.
Yeah, we did.
And I know that song. You know that song. Yeah. If anyone doesn't, well, you weren't watching TV in the mid-'80s to mid-'90s.
On Monday nights.
Monday nights, CBS, it was Designing Women. Mm-hmm. And it was directed by an Arkansas native, Harry Thomason, was created by his wife, Linda Bloodworth Thomason. So we're going to talk about Harry. Mm-hmm. He got his start in Arkansas. He was born in Hampton in 1940 and moved to Little Rock and started his career as a high school science teacher and football coach. He was at McClellan High School and just, I don't know, just got kind of tired of it and thought about, you know, what could he do different that would really catch his interest and sort of be his dream job. And he told me he had grown up liking photography. His mother even set him up a little dark room in a closet. So he was always interested in the visuals. And so he thought, I want to make movies. He always wanted to make movies and decided to get into the production business. He went to a local ad agency and finagled his way into getting to produce a political campaign for a gubernatorial candidate. And they liked it. And he continued to get work as a local production commercial kind of thing. But he really wanted to make movies. So his first film was called Encounter with the Unknown. Hmm. Now, this is a clip from the KATV archives from 1972, and Thomas is at a news conference announcing the premiere of the movie, and it was low budget, you know, first effort, shot in Arkansas on a shoestring. And you can tell from this news conference, it really shows, even if you want a movie, even if you shoot a movie, it's tough to just get it on the screen.
Of a first-time motion picture company that starts out to make a feature film, only 1 out of 10 ever finished the film. We had people on our staff from the Dallas area, and at least one of them had worked on 9 motion pictures. And most of them were the $500,000 class and through there. And they'll be here Tuesday night, and this will be the first motion picture, I mean the first feature they've ever worked on that was screened before paying off.
I talked to him last week at his home in California. Unfortunately, it was by phone. I didn't get to go out there.
Right.
But here's what he had to say about, I guess you'd call it, his humble beginnings as a movie maker.
There had been a couple of movies made in Arkansas, I think, many years prior, and then my childhood friend, Charlie Pierce, made Boggy Creek and then went on to make some other great movies, and so we both were starting out there about that time, switched equipment back and forth. Any people we knew that could help back and forth, but I was the first up, and I wanted to call it Rod Serling's Encounter with the Unknown. And so I came out here and I talked to a guy. I was trying to get some cast members in it, and he happened to know Rod Serling, and Rod Serling read it and said, okay, you can do that. So he blessed the movie for us, and we shot it in 13 days and with $69,000, and it never made a great deal of money, but it got out there and it played, you know. And it showed us we could do it.
I'm talking with Randy Dixon, and that is a conversation you had earlier this month with Harry Thomason. He was in his California home.
That's right, and he did make that movie
and
made it in Arkansas. Plus, he got Rod Serling to be the narrator, Twilight Zone,
Night Gallery,
all those shows. He was the voice of the 60s and 70s.
Yes.
Especially when it came to encounters with the unknown, But he also mentioned, I think he called him Charlie Pierce,
mm-hmm.
Charles B. Pierce, who we've done a segment about before, and he's done his own batch of movies that were memorable. I just didn't realize they had grown up together.
They were childhood friends.
Yeah,
right?
And started making movies about the same time. But he continued to produce movies in Arkansas and kind of learn along the way. And here he's announcing in 1974 his newest film, and he's talking about he's picked up a distributor. So he has learned something. This movie's called The Great Lester Boggs.
We've been doing our own distributing in the past, and it makes it difficult for us to cover the country. And like with our first two films, we still covered less than 20% of the country. And so now we've entered into this agreement with Star Master International, which will give us the needed capital and the expertise that we need to make it a truly worldwide big league film, so to speak.
There is a face in The Great Lester Boggs who is familiar to people of a certain age.
Right. And on two different fronts. One, if you're a pro football fan, and one, if you like a bawdy comedy that happens to be a Western.
Well, and he was also a star of a sitcom for a while. He was on Webster.
Yeah, we're talking about Alex Karras, who he was featured in this Lester Boggs movie, but we know he later was Mongo on Mel Brooks's Blazing Saddles.
Mongo, just a pawn in life.
Yes.
Yes.
So Thomas's big break came when he bought the rights to a film. And that's a whole story in itself that I don't think we have time for, but it's really interesting that he read a story in Reader's Digest, found out who the story was about, contacted the family, and they happened to have some Arkansas ties, of course.
Right.
And he got the rights to the story with a song, for a song. So anyway, Columbia Pictures ended up optioning and making the movie, and he said, only if I can produce it. So he was offered a permanent gig, but he wanted to stay in Arkansas.
And he said, Harry, you want a deal here? And I said, yes, sir, but I don't want to quit going to Little Rock, so I'm not asking about one. He said, what would you want? I said, I want to work for Columbia. And I want to be able to fly to Little Rock every Thursday night and fly back here on Monday morning so I don't have to move. And he said, okay, we're going to make a contract with you for 2 years. And that's what happens. And that is what happens.
With this movie we were talking about with Columbia, they couldn't find any good writers. And Harry said, well, I think I know somebody. And I said, you don't even live out in Hollywood. How do you have connections? He said, no, I have this friend named Bill Harrison, who's a great writer. And they said, are you talking about the Bill Harrison that is the author at University of Arkansas? And he said, yeah, I can just call him up and see if he'll help us work on this. And, yeah, he did. So Harry is really starting to impress these big wigs out in L.A. But one of his first big producing jobs was for that CBS miniseries, The Blue and the Gray.
Which we have highlighted before.
We have. And they asked him to scout locations around the country. And he went all around. And he was in Arkansas visiting family and just drove around Northwest Arkansas and went back to them and said, that's the place to shoot it. And so they shot the entire film just right around here, the Fayetteville area. But I did find this 1983 report from KATV's Philip Bruce about the production, and you'll hear Harry in this.
Production crews from Columbia Pictures have been scouting for locations in western Arkansas for about a month now. In all, they will need more than 300 different sites to film the 8-hour miniseries. As it stands now, most of the film will be shot in northwest Arkansas, with much of it taking place in and around Fayetteville. The producer of the film, Harry Thomason, a former high school football coach from Little Rock, has found one possible location at an old home near Fayetteville's Mount Sequoia. Film crews will be shooting in western Arkansas at locations like this one for about 3 months. The project will cost Columbia Pictures more than $15 million, and the movie will employ more than 2,000 actors in speaking and non-speaking roles.
We call for a lot of extras. We reproduce certain scenes from several of the major battles in the Civil War, and so we'll use a lot of extras. In fact, within the next couple of weeks, we will have casting people in here that will begin to sort through the people. We're not only going to cast extras from here, I mean, we're going to cast speaking roles. And so they will be in first to cast what speaking roles we can in the show.
The movie will be based on Bruce Catton's Pulitzer Prize-winning trilogy on the Civil War. Shooting is expected to begin sometime next month and will continue on through Christmas. Philip Bruce, News Scene 7, Fayetteville.
But again, Harry used some of his connections in Arkansas, and it paid off big. So the next year, he married Linda Bloodworth, who was another producer out in L.A., and they formed Mozart Productions, which I'm sure you've heard of.
Yes, and so she was from Poplar Bluff, Missouri,
yes,
is that right? Yeah, so a small town in the Missouri Ozarks,
mm-hmm.
Right.
So it was the perfect name for their production company. But then came the TV series that changed both their lives, and it was Mozart Productions that did this series. And so when I talked to Harry last week, he told me about a meeting with the studio executives when they were wanting to pitch ideas for Linda to do.
They were sitting in a room proposing a show they would like to see her do. And she says, no, what I'd really like to do is this show called Designing Women. And she told them what it was all about, and the guys, they just said, we just don't think a woman show would work on television right now. I mean, we're all women and all the, you know. And she said, well, I think it would. And about that time, the phone rang. It was in her office, and she picked up the phone, and it was a guy, again, from CBS. Not the same guy, but it was a guy from CBS, and he said, Linda, we just been thinking you ought to come over and pitch a story to us. You know, we think it's ready for you to do something. And she and the guys from Columbia were sitting in there, and they said, oh, Linda, don't. They were whispering, don't tell them anything yet. You don't want to do that show. And Linda just went right ahead and said, well, I want to do a show about four women, and it's called Designing Women, and it's got all these women in it and just about their lives. And what happens to them. And the guy on the phone said, listen, why don't you come over here? I think we can sell that show right now. Can you be here before? And the guys from Columbia were waving their arms, and by then they quit waving their arms and started smiling, being happy. And as soon as Linda hung up and told them what they could hear a little of what she was talking about, and if they've agreed to it and they want to make it, but they just want her to come explain it to the president. And by then, they were pumping their arms in the air and getting on the call, calling their bosses and saying, we just sold one. So we all went to Designing Women that afternoon.
Designing Women was a big hit from, I guess it was 86 to 93, with Linda Bloodworth Thomason as the creator and producer, and Harry Thomason as the director and producer.
Which would also be the roles when they did a sequel on stage at Theater Squared.
That's right. It was just here, last year?
Yeah.
So let's move into his political world, and this has to do with the Clintons.
Of course it does.
Of course. So he had known the Clintons for years, before he ran for president, when he was governor. And so when he did run for president, both the Thomases were very involved in the campaign. They produced their commercial ads, and Linda did the Man from Hope,
Oh, at the convention.
Yes, yeah. And that's what introduced Bill Clinton to the country, and it was beautifully done. Mm-hmm. They found that picture of Clinton in the White House.
Right.
With
John Kennedy.
With John Kennedy.
When Clinton was a teenager from Boys State.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, but it was a great flick, and I covered the Clinton campaign from start to finish in 92 into 93. And everywhere I went, I would see Harry. And he, I think, he just did everything. He was responsible for sort of the look on television and the appearance and the image of the visual image of the campaign. After the campaign ended, he was even involved in the inauguration. And I didn't think it was down to this minute of a detail, but I found this news report in the archives, and he was involved in the distribution of invitations to the inauguration itself.
Wow.
So here's what he had to say about that.
I never want to hear the word ticket again as long as I live. Because it's very tough. I mean, we started out to make this the most accessible inauguration ever, and we're trying to take as many people as we can. That doesn't include only actors. That includes farmers in Ohio that worked on the campaign, too, and we've tried to be very even-handed.
And then even after the inauguration and Bill Clinton's term, he was still kind of connected. He and Linda were still kind of connected to the Clintons, weren't they?
Yes, and to the point that he did, he directed a documentary years later, in 2004. It was based on a book by Joe Connison and Gene Lyons from Little Rock.
Mm-hmm.
It was called The Hunting of the President, the 10-year campaign to destroy Bill and Hillary Clinton. So here's part of the trailer for that.
This is the inauguration reviewing staff.
Here is where Bill Clinton will make his oath of office.
William Jefferson Clinton.
There was a sense in Washington that Clinton was not their kind of person.
The strategy was to use anything to inflict damage to his presidency.
But I have a great story if I can tell it.
Please.
What I learned from Harry on the campaign trail. We were, I think, in New Hampshire, and Clinton was supposed to coming out to speak, and the media was all setting up. And I look across the room, and I see Harry on his hands and knees at the foot of the governor's podium. And I was curious what he was up to, so I went over and said, Harry, what are you doing? And he said, well, the governor has had some late nights this week on the campaign trail, and he's got these bad bags under his eyes. So I'm dropping a light, a little spotlight, on the floor shooting straight up through the podium to kind of knock those dark bags off. So I thought, well, that's kind of cool. And I didn't think about it for, I don't know, a decade or two. But we had a young man coming into the station to apply for a weekend weather job. So we put him out in the studio to do an audition and turned on the cameras and had him in front of the green screen. And he had these terrible dark circles under his eyes. And they were trying to, you know, fix it electronically. And bam, I remembered what Harry had done. So I looked at the director and said, hey, can we get a key light and just set it on the floor and shoot it straight up? And sure enough, and from then on, there was always a key light. And whenever he would do the weather, they'd say, oh, turn on the yak light. So that was for Todd Yacobian.
Wow.
And I went to the station just a few months ago, and I'll be dadgum, that yak light was still on the floor. Now he's gone to KARK.
Right.
I don't know if they use one or not. But Anyway, that was my great little lighting trick I learned from Harry Thomason.
And I'll go back to what I said about Harry Thomason. He's a show guy.
He is.
He's a show, and I don't mean this in a fake way. He's a show business guy. He knows how things work.
Yeah, and what I thought was great is, and I believe this to be true, he didn't say this, but this is the way I take his stories, is that to be a good producer, you don't have to have the connections out in L.A. You don't. It's a frame of mind. It's a skill set. Mm-hmm. And he used his skill set to get the job done, whether, you know, it was an award-winning writer in Arkansas or having a connection to someone who had a script, because they have to – it's using what you know and what you have.
Right.
And that's what he did.
All right, and you can find Harry Thomason on the Pryor Center website, too.
Yes, we did an interview with him in about 2014, I believe it was, at the Hot Springs Documentary Film Festival. And it's a great interview. We have it in its entirety. Just go to the Pryor Center website and go to look at Arkansas Memories, and you'll see Harry Thomason.
All right, and you and I will be back next Monday with another subject of Arkansas history.
I'll think of something.
You always do. Thank you, Randy Dixon.
Thanks.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
One day, little girl.
True Grit is the second and best known of Arkansas-er Charles Portis's five novels. Portis was born in El Dorado and also lived in Hamburg and Ashley County growing up and in Little Rock as an adult. True Grit was released as a novel in 1968 after running as a serial in the Saturday Evening Post magazine. The next year, True Grit was adapted into a movie that won John Wayne his only Academy Award and was the film debut of Pike County, Arkansas native Glenn Campbell. Campbell, who starred as the Texas Ranger named LaBeef, is heard here singing the Oscar-nominated title song of the film.
Someone who's kind, someone who is fearless like you.
Glenn Campbell's single, True Grit, Someday Little Girl, released in July 1969, hit the top 10 in the U.S. and went to number one in Canada. Elmer Bernstein wrote the lyrics and also wrote and conducted the rest of the instrumental score. According to the liner notes of the soundtrack, Campbell had one particular advantage over the rest of the cast. True Grit takes place largely in Arkansas, and he is a native of that state. True Grit is mostly set around Fort Smith, Arkansas, and points west when neighboring Oklahoma was still Indian territory. Narrator Maddie Ross is from Dardanelle in Yell County, a fact she finds reason to mention fairly often.
Run on for a long time, sooner or later gotta cut you down, sooner or later gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut him down, tell him that God's gonna cut him down.
The film adaptation of True Grit was such a success that the following year, an adaptation of Charles Portis's first novel, Norwood, was released, also starring Glenn Campbell and his True Grit co-star, Kim Darby. Although the Norwood film flopped, audiences couldn't forget True Grit. A 1975 sequel, not written by Portis, called Rooster Cogburn, starred John Wayne and Katharine Hepburn. A made-for-TV movie called True Grit, A Further Adventure, came in 1978.
What a fellowship, what a joy divine, leaning on the everlasting arms.
In 2010, Joel and Ethan Coen directed another film adaptation of True Grit, one considered more faithful to the source material. Little Rock native Leon Russom, who also appeared in the 1998 Coen Brothers film The Big Lebowski, plays a minor role. And again, music for the film comes from Arkansas-ers. Cleveland County native Johnny Cash's God's Gonna Cut You Down, heard previously, was used in the trailer. Leaning on the Everlasting Arms, heard here, is a musical theme heard throughout the 2010 version, which was scored by Carter Burwell. Paragould native Iris DeMent's version of the hymn is used during the film's end credits.
Oh, how
written by an Arkansaser and featuring such natural state notables as Glenn Campbell, Hanging Judge Isaac Parker, Johnny Cash, Iris DeMent, U.S. Marshal Reuben J. Rooster Cogburn, and of course, tough narrator Matty Ross of Yell County. There may never be a more Arkansas-centric property than Union County native Charles Portis's True Grit, nor one as beloved by the rest of the world. From the motion picture soundtrack to the original film version of True Grit, based on El Dorado native Charles Portis's novel, here's Pike County native Glenn Campbell with his Oscar-nominated song, True Grit, Someday, Little Girl, from July 1969.
One day, little girl, the sadness will leave your face as soon as you've won your fight to get just as done. Some days, little girl, you'll wonder what life's about, but others have known battles are won alone, so you look around to find someone who's kind, someone who is fearless like you. The pain of it will ease a bit when you find a man with true grit. One day you will rise, and you won't believe your eyes. You'll wake up and see a world that is fine and free. Though summer seems far away, you'll find the sun.
County native Glenn Campbell with the Oscar-nominated Top 10 title song from the original film version of True Grit, released in July 1969. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs.
Arkansas Arts Council bringing Arkansas performers and audiences together through its Arts on Tour grant. Learn more at arkansasarts.org.
Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, and KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. On tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large, we'll talk with guitarist Marisa Anderson. She's coming back to Northwest Arkansas for a performance later this week. We'll discuss her atmospheric technique and just how many guitars she owns and plays and much more. That's on tomorrow's show. Contributors to today's show included Matthew Moore, Josie Lenora, Randy Dixon, Stephen Cook, and the newsroom at KUAR Little Rock Public Radio. Our underwriting director at KUAF is Ryan Versey. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for being with us. Back with a new show tomorrow.
The Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society's 26th season of the Summer Jazz Concert Series presents the Eddie Gomez Trio, featuring Stephen Carlson and Stephen Pruitt, Sunday, June 30th at 7 p.m. Information and tickets at digjazz.com. Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville invites guests to explore nature's wonders at their exhibition, Exquisite Creatures, open now and on display until July 29th. This exhibit showcases the colorful animals, plants, and minerals found in nature. Tickets and information at crystalbridges.org.